from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Be absolutely vigilant, and when you see an assault on freedom, you pick up the telephone or you email the great friends of religious freedom, and the good news is there are so many of them.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Ken Starr, author of the new book, Religious Liberty in Crisis. We'll talk at length with Ken a bit later on in today's program. Our first guest today is Dr. Will Morrissey, Professor Emeritus of Politics at Hillsdale College, author of Self-Government, The American Theme, also a book review site, willmorrisseyreviews.com. Dr. Morrissey, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, and I'm glad to be here.
We talked today about a piece you wrote over at realclearpublicaffairs.com, part of their 1776 series, titled Civic and Moral Virtues, The American Way. What did the founders understand about virtue that might be missing in contemporary America?
Contemporary America, I think we've forgotten what virtue really is. We tend to confuse it with sentiments or emotions or even passions. So, for example, we'll think of a person who is virtuous as someone who is outraged or someone who shows compassion, which is, after all, a compassion, or respect, which is, again, it's a sentiment. It's not a virtue. Virtue really means strength. That's the Latin root of it. And it means strength of character. A strength of character for a human being means the display of the distinctive human characteristic, which is reason, moral reasoning. It's not morality isn't just a matter of sentiments or emotions. It's a matter of reasoning, and that's why the Declaration of Independence is not just a list of assertions. It's actually a logical argument. It's what philosophy professors. I'm not one, but philosophy professors call them syllogisms.
Mm-hmm.
And a syllogism is an argument that's structured in a certain way. It starts out with a premise, what's called a major premise. Then it goes to a minor premise or premises. And then it reaches a conclusion based on those two things. So, for example, the classic example is all men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Major premise, minor premise, conclusion, Socrates is mortal. The Declaration of Independence works exactly that way. It's a specimen of moral and civic reasoning. Starts out with the major premises, all men are created equal, natural rights, government by consent. Then it has that long list of grievances against the king, which means that the basis of which is that the king is violating those natural rights. He's contradicting the major premises of the argument. And the conclusion then is a logical conclusion, a reasoned conclusion, which is that these American states, these United States, are and ought to be free and independent. So that's basically the difference between virtue as they understand it and as was understood for centuries and the way we understand it today.
Talking with Dr. Will Morrissey about his piece at realclearpublicaffairs.com, Civic and Moral Virtue, The American Way. The first virtue you mention in the piece is decency. What did the founders understand by using the term decency, and what does decency look like maybe when you combine it with courage?
Decency means fitness. That's the Latin root. And don't forget, all these men knew Latin. So they were well aware of the original meaning of these terms when they used them in English. It means what's fit and appropriate. So a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, which is one of the opening phrases of the Declaration of Independence, means not just any old respect. It's a respect based on addressing the other nations of the world in an appropriate way. What's an appropriate way to address the other nations in the world? It would be addressing them with an argument, a reasoned argument, which appeals to their human nature, but also an argument that appeals to the law of nations. The law of nations is a combination of natural law, such as equality, natural equality, human rights, and so on. But it's also the settled customs that nations have developed over the centuries for dealing with one another so that there are no misunderstandings, unnecessary wars. So, for example, if two ships from different countries meet at sea, there are certain protocols that they follow. And the protocols are designed to protect the natural rights of the sailors who are confronting one another so that they don't get into an unnecessary dispute. So that's what decency means.
Talking with Dr. Will Morrissey about his piece at realclearpublicaffairs.com, Civic and Moral Virtues, The American Way. We talk about great men. Of course, we can talk about George Washington. In what ways did he embody the founding's conception of civic and moral virtue?
He was really there. He was the most respected and decently respected, to use the Declaration's phrase. He was the most respected man among them by his peers, by his colleagues. And, of course, the famous phrase about George Washington is he was first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. He was first in war because he displayed, among other things, the virtue of courage, of course, battlefield courage. He was one of those generals who was out on the battlefield and not back in an office somewhere. And the other thing he displayed was prudence. So, for example, when he was clearly outmanned and outgunned in New York City, he didn't do a Custer's last stand. He got out of town, retreated across New Jersey, and then got into Pennsylvania where they couldn't get at him. Then he displayed prudence, because what he did was that famous surprise attack during the winter on Trenton. So he displayed some of the classical virtues as a warrior, as a warrior. And the main classical virtues that are relevant to war is are courage and prudence, planning, being able to be good both tactically and strategically. That's practical wisdom, practical reasoning. In peace, and you see this in his farewell address very clearly, which is a great thing to read, he doesn't want to keep wars going. Once the war has been settled, he wants to show magnanimity, and he wants others to show magnanimity to the United States. He wants to stay out of their quarrels as much as possible, unless there's some huge national emergency, of course, that threatens the security of America. But normally, we don't play power politics, we don't play balance of power in Europe, and we don't want them doing that over here. That's a virtue in peace that he displayed again and again with his diplomatic missions throughout his administration. And as far as being first in the hearts of his countrymen, he was the most conspicuously virtuous of all the founders.
To close, I want to ask about a phrase that most people, I would think, have heard, and that is this pledge of sacred honor, which was mentioned. What does that mean, to pledge sacred honor to one's fellow Americans? And is that something we should perhaps keep more in mind today?
Well, it sure is something we should keep in mind today, and in any day, for that matter. Sacred basically means devoted. In religious context, it obviously means devoted to God. In the context of the American founding and in the Declaration, they're about to put their lives on the line, and they need to be able to trust one another. They need to be able to say, we have your back, as we say nowadays. And that means that they need to stand on their honor as gentlemen and ladies, right? They're not, and in doing so, they are displaying both the moral and the civic virtues, because those are the honorable things. You dishonor human beings that are acting subhuman, right? As subhumans. You honor human beings who are acting the way human beings should act. And that's what they did with one another, and that's what they did before the world.
Dr. Will Morrissey, Professor Emeritus of Politics at Hillsdale College, author of Self-Government, The American Theme, and WillMorrisseyReviews.com, book reviews at that site. You can also find his piece at RealClearPublicAffairs.com, Civic and Moral Virtues, The American Way. Dr. Morrissey, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
Up next, we'll talk with Ken Starr about his latest book, Religious Liberty in Crisis. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
North State Now is a magazine formatted show at 6 p.m. every Thursday night. The first Thursday is yours truly, Linda Bott, featuring what's going on in our town. The second Thursday is hosted by Michelle Slade, featuring heroes of the North State. The third Thursday is hosted by none other than James Masada and Rhonda Alvey from Enjoy the Magazine and Enjoy the Store. Our newest edition is the fourth Thursday of the month, Women of Vision. That's North State Now, Thursday at 6 p.m., also streaming on KCNR 1460.com.
Shasta Miners and Prospectors Association is a nonprofit group that helps small-scale miners and prospectors while educating the public about mining. They offer gold-bearing claims that members can use, and they hold monthly meetings that are open to the public. If you are interested in prospecting, mining, metal detecting, or treasure hunting, please join the Shasta Miners and Prospectors Association by downloading the application on our website.
KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at am1460.com. Don't miss Free Fire Radio weekday mornings from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott. From 9 to noon, be informed and laugh along with Armstrong and Getty, the conscience of the nation. From noon to 3, find your financial peace with Dave Ramsey. From 3 to 6, don't miss constitutional expert Mark Levin. Monday through Thursday night, starting at 6 p.m., we have local shows featuring everything from the paranormal to riding routes, pop culture, and unsung heroes in the North State. From 7 to 10, tune into Ben Shapiro with an expanded program that brings the issues of the day to your radio. KCNR also has an incredible weekend lineup, including The Plotline, Jefferson State of Mind, Sovereign Minds, and We the People on KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at KCNR1460.com.
Hi, I'm Sue Blake with Powerhouse Solar. Solar energy not only makes financial sense, but right now you can go solar for zero money down. And you may qualify to get the 26% federal tax credit. At Powerhouse Solar, we are an elite dealer for SunPower, and we install the most cost-effective and highest efficiency panels. A lot of people don't realize they have options now. You can get the SunPower SunVault battery and solar with financing. So keeping the lights on when the grid goes down is easier than ever. And the entire system is backed by their 25-year warranty. Powerhouse Solar can design a system for your specific needs. Call Powerhouse Solar today at 275-5600 or visit us on the web at powerhousesolar.com. Again, call Powerhouse Solar at 275-5600 or visit us online at powerhousesolar.com.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Today we're talking about Trinidad's Espiritu Series No. 2, crafted with tobaccos from Brazil and Nicaragua and wrapped in an Arapiraca leaf. Espiritu No. 2 produces a harmonious, medium to full-bodied cigar with extraordinary zesty complexity and earthy notes. Come by the shop and pick up your Trinidad Espiritu No. 2 today, 2143 Hilltop Drive, Reading.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Ken Starr. He's the author of the new book, Religious Liberty in Crisis, Exercising Your Faith in an Age of Uncertainty. Previously president and chancellor at Baylor, dean of Pepperdine Law School, he's argued 36 cases in front of the Supreme Court of the United States, including some during his time as U.S. Solicitor General. Ken, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott. Thank you for having me on.
A very interesting new book here, Religious Liberty in Crisis. I wanted to start by asking for, I guess, somewhat of a definition. When we talk about religious liberty, what protections should we be thinking of that are afforded religion under the law?
The ability to carry on our faith, including through churches and synagogues and other institutions, and to put that faith into action through exercising our faith without interference from the government. We're not asking for government support. We're not asking for the government to say, well, whatever goes on inside a church is beyond our ken entirely. Think of the horror of child abuse and so forth. But what we are saying is the government, in order to interfere with the lawful exercise of religious faith, must have a compellingly strong reason, and to not interfere with our exercise of religious faith to the to just minimize any interference that the government believes is absolutely compelled.
We have had, Ken, a couple of religious liberty rulings from the Supreme Court recently, and most have looked pretty good on the side of religious liberty. What is it about this particular time, though, that is troubling and prompts you to say that liberty is in crisis?
It is because around the country, governments, local, typically local, school boards, other folks who wield government power are taking actions that are trenching upon religious conscience, upon faith-based conscience. It's happening not just in California and New York. It's happening literally everywhere. I was on a group group call with pastors in the Houston, Texas area, and they were recalling how a few years ago the then mayor of Houston subpoenaed through the city attorney their sermon notes and their sermons. This is just extraordinary. Who would have thought of that 10 years ago or 15 years ago could possibly happen in the United States of America? And the reason is there's increasing hostility to religious expression, the cancel culture, and also the cultural movements that say, I'm sorry, you must conform your behavior to our idea of the good and fair and just society, and there are no exceptions. And this, again, represents a sea change in America's culture that has been heretofore very assiduously concerned about the religious liberty and the freedom of conscience of all persons. That has changed, and it changed very quickly. That's what created, I believe, the crisis for religious liberty in the United States of America.
Ken Starr is with us. His new book, Religious Liberty in Crisis. You mentioned the phrase autonomy a bit ago, and you call it in the book the key to religious liberty. Why is that so? And what does it look like practically when the autonomy begins to be chipped away at?
Well, let's take the live example that I use in the book, which is a note of warning and then a note of hope. During the Obama administration, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, took the position that a Christian school had no more rights than the Boy Scouts. And so when it was taking action, firing a teacher, and the teacher maintained that that firing was a violation of federal civil rights laws. And those are very important laws. They're vitally important. They're precious laws. And I'm thankful for them. But when those laws interfere with the autonomy, the ability of a church school to decide who will teach and who will not teach, then there is trouble right here in River City. And sure enough, the EEOC and the Obama administration pressed very hard on behalf of the teacher, and it was a very sympathetic set of facts, needless to say, against the Christian school. The Supreme Court of the United States unanimously rebuffed the EEOC, and this included Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who of course is now deceased, and Sonia Sotomayor, who's still serving. All nine justices rebuffed the EEOC under President Obama and President Obama's Justice Department and said, you can't do this. As important as those laws are, you cannot interfere with the right of a church school or a church institution to say who will in fact be a transmitter of the faith. Huge, huge example. By the way, the lower courts got it wrong, right? That the civil rights laws represent this compelling state interest, and so the government, the federal government, can intrude. think of, second example, Jack Phillips, the cake, specialty cake, custom cake baker in Colorado. The Colorado Public Public Accommodations Commission, Civil Rights Commission, said you violated state law by declining to bake a cake to celebrate a couple, same-sex couple's wedding. And the Supreme Court held 7-2 that in its approach, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had evinced a hostility to religion. Isn't that what we're seeing around the country? Aren't we seeing that in the culture, a hostility to religion? And the Supreme Court of the United States has stood four square to saying governmental hostility to religion is simply absolutely forbidden.
Ken, you say in the book that equality provides a powerful organizing principle for Friends of Freedom, and that's inside of the Discrimination in the Schoolhouse chapter. It does seem that that question of equality pops up a whole lot when it comes to schools.
Exactly right. And schools should be able to participate. Christian schools should be able to participate in school choice programs. They should not be excluded from, and obviously we're talking about parents applying for scholarships and the like. And the Supreme Court, again, by an overwhelming supermajority, said in the context of a church school which was applying for a grant, this is again the state level, we're not talking about Washington, D.C., but this was a Missouri case, and a Trinity Church says, gosh, our playground is a little bit dangerous. They applied for a program so that those used tires are turned into
yes,
that wonderful spongy material you can jump up and down safely. And the Missouri State authorities said, well, you've written a fantastic application. You rank very high, but you're a church. Go away. And the Supreme Court of the United States said, you can't do that. You cannot exclude a church school playground from participation, and thus you must, in fact, treat that church school on the same equal footing as a secular playground application. Very powerful principle.
We'll pause right there, talk more about schools in just a moment. Ken Starr is with us. His new book is Religious Liberty in Crisis. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Common Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
A building that's meant to last is not built overnight. And for centuries, the cornerstone has been crucial to guide each brick and wall that comes after. A strong community relies on many cornerstones. So at Cornerstone Community Bank, we've taken our name to heart. Whether it's your business or your family, we'll provide the financial cornerstone that you need to build on. We're local. We're community. We're your cornerstone. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
a jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Zip on over to Drip, now open at 2766 Falls Ferry Road in Anderson, next to Anytime Fitness. Drip features healthy and delicious drinks and shakes. Drip offers energy teas packed with antioxidants, delicious full meal replacement shakes, coffee loaded with protein, power oats, energy drinks, and so much more. Drip is open Monday through Friday from 7 to 7 and weekends 8 to 4. Stop by today, 2766 Falls Ferry Road in Anderson. Zip on over to Drip.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertrand. We've been talking with Ken Starr about his brand new book, Religious Liberty in Crisis, Exercising Your Faith in an Age of Uncertainty. And the topic of schools is where we last paused. There's a whole chapter in Religious Liberty in Crisis on vouchers. Vouchers on trial, the idea of school choice and the idea of vouchers, which is a reality in some states. Are vouchers on solid footing based on recent decisions from the Supreme Court?
Yes, there's great news. Once again, the trial courts got it wrong. The courts of appeals got it wrong. And the Supreme Court got it right, vindicating vouchers. That came, the case came out of Ohio. I was privileged to serve as outside counsel to the Attorney General of Ohio in that case. It is settled. It is good law that voucher programs, school choice programs, are now constitutionally sacrosanct. Now, they're not required, right? But if a state or a city sees fit to institute this kind of program, the way Tommy Thompson, the governor of Wisconsin, did now almost a generation ago, then that is protected as part of our bucket of rights under religious liberty. And that, again, is due to a very fine opinion by the Supreme Court of the United States.
And before we step away from the schools, one more question. You talk about this in the book, and it's a Supreme Court case from just last year, the Our Lady of Guadalupe case involving the ministerial exception for hiring practices at these religious schools. Why is that so important?
It's very important for schools to be able to say, we don't think that you, dear teacher or administrator, are really carrying on the job as we want it to be carried on, and we get to make that choice. Again, that brings us back to that precious principle of the autonomy of church schools, and you're exactly right, Scott. The Supreme Court has once again, when that principle came under test, and by the way, the lower courts got it wrong, they allowed the intrusion into these hiring and firing decisions, and the Supreme Court of the United States, by, again, a very strong 7-2 supermajority, Justice Ginsburg was still on the court at that time, and on this particular occasion, because it was a different set of facts than that earlier case that I described, and so it was a harder case, but still the Supreme Court upheld the autonomy of those church institutions. And what this book is designed to do is to equip every single person to enter the public square and to be an informed participant in the public square. And that may mean standing up at your school board and saying, you know, what you're doing here, what you're proposing to do here, really is tugging at a principle that is, I'm not a lawyer, but what I do know is the principle of equality, the principle of non-discrimination, the principle of autonomy, and so forth. You'll be equipped as a citizen to, in fact, engage in the public debate and to be able to be a friend of freedom.
Ken Starr with us, the book Religious Liberty in Crisis, Exercising Your Faith in an Age of Uncertainty. I want to talk about accommodation, because you spend some time talking about accommodation as well. There are often those on the other side who will argue, when it comes to these questions of accommodation, that a government actually is engaged in establishment, in establishing religion by these accommodations. Where do you draw the line? How do you delineate that?
Yes, it is consistent with our constitutional principles as well as our culture for government to, in fact, accommodate religious belief and practice. And so by way of example, and this is coming back, it's on its way back as a real burning issue. When the issue arose as to tax exemption of churches, and it was a very carefully calibrated challenge, we're only challenging the property tax exemption of the church building itself, just the sanctuary. Oh, if there's a church school, if there is an area that provides other social services, oh no, we would not want to interfere with that. It was very pure, very carefully thought out. The Supreme Court of the United States unanimously held that churches enjoy exemptions just like museums and other institutions that provide and promote the social good. That's an accommodation. The key case that gave rise to this is one we can all understand. It's from a different generation, and that was when the New York City schools accommodated religious belief and practice by allowing children in the public schools of New York City to depart one day a week early to go to their respective religious institutions for religious training. So right, so the priests, the rabbis, and the pastors weren't coming into the schools, but they were permitting the schools go. That was challenged to say, well, wait a second, you're not permitting the kids to leave to go to art class, right, or to go to the museum. What is this? This is a violation of the Establishment Clause. The Supreme Court, speaking through a very liberal voice, Justice William O. Douglas said, this is in our finest traditions in the United States to accommodate religious belief and practice. You're not forcing anyone, mm-hmm. So there's not coercion at work.
Ken, I'm not the first to make this observation, but there is a subset of those who oppose religious freedom, or at least do so in practice, who essentially say, look, you can believe what you want. It's when you act on those beliefs that we have problems. Is this what you mean when you talk about the harm principle late in the book?
Yes, because your exercise, so the charge goes, of religious freedom is harming me. It's harming my dignity, my sense, or it may even interfere with my ability to get a service that I would like. The classic case now is the Hobby Lobby decision of the Supreme Court. Again, the Supreme Court got it right and struck another mighty blow for religious liberty. Hobby Lobby, wonderful group of stores owned by a believing family, an evangelical Christian family, could not, in conscience, provide certain forms of contraceptives mandated by the Obama administration. In the view of these members of the family, four of the 21 mandated services and methods constituted abortifacients. In their view, and there was science behind their view, this is not a conspiracy theory, there was science behind their view, this was taking the life that there was, in fact, conception, and this, of course, ends the life of that unborn child. The Supreme Court upheld the ability of the Green family to decline to provide those particular kinds of contraceptives. Time and again, people of conscience are moved to say, I can't do that in conscience. And then the government may come in and say, okay, we will accommodate that. Or what the Obama administration did is to test and push and say, no, no, no. If you are in business, you're going to have to violate your conscience. So to come back to your basic question, of course we're free to believe. Of course we're free to worship, although we've had the church closing cases during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But we also are protected in the free exercise of religion, right? It's not a freedom to worship alone that's protected. It's to exercise your freedom. And to exercise your freedom means you're out and about doing things that may have some impact on some human being. And the question is that free exercise of your faith going to be protected or not? That's the issue of our day.
Ken Starr with us, the book Religious Liberty in Crisis. You have said a number of times during the course of our discussion, the Supreme Court got it right. That's a great thing, but we all know that many of us who have these conflicts, our conflicts won't make it to the Supreme Court. We deal with this on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis. What can we do, what can our listeners do to protect our rights?
Be absolutely vigilant, and when you see an assault on freedom, and I discuss this, in fact, I dedicate the book to freedom warriors, you pick up the telephone or you email the great friends of religious freedom, and the good news is that there are so many of them. I'll just use one. I'm going to be with them this very week. Alliance Defending Freedom. But there are others. First Liberty. For those in the Roman Catholic faith community, the Beckett Fund. There are so many of these groups that deserve our help, deserve our support, but they are there to give advice, counsel, and to take on litigation, and they are overwhelmingly successful. Why? Because they are great lawyers who are espousing the great principles of American liberty.
Ken Starr, the author of the new book, Religious Liberty in Crisis, Exercising Your Faith in an Age of Uncertainty. Ken, thanks so much for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, Dan Copeland from Hillsdale's Education Department will guide us through Aesop's Fables. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The Turtle Bay Spring Plant Sale has been extended. You can now enjoy discounts at the nursery all April long. We grow California native and climate acclimated plants from around the world, primed to grow strong and healthy right in your own backyard. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Compass Sports Cards, locally owned and operated at 1620 East Cypress Avenue across from Hill Collision Center, is your home base for trading cards and signed sports memorabilia with modern and vintage sports cards and collectibles. Compass Sports Cards features baseball, basketball, football cards, and is the largest supplier of non-sports Pokemon cards. Buy, sell, or trade with Compass Sports Cards, open from 11 to 6 Monday through Saturday. Do you have a collection? Have it appraised at Compass Sports Cards before or after hours at 1620 East Cypress Avenue. Call 355-2016 or stop by today and check us out on Facebook, Compass Sports Cards.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to a North State with no more homeless pets.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 and 1460 AM.
Convert your calling into a career at Shasta College this summer. Get a jump start on being transfer ready for a CSU, UC, or four-year university. Or boost your current career skills quickly and affordably with a certificate or degree from Shasta College. Our summer session offers flexible class times and formats with online and some in-person offerings that easily fit around jobs and family responsibilities. Right now is the perfect time to invest in your future. A degree or certificate from a community college will pay dividends throughout your lifetime with an average annual wage of almost $53,000. And at Shasta College, our industry partners are actively looking to hire qualified candidates from our programs to fill the many positions they have open. Financial aid through grants and scholarships can help you invest in your education without a huge bill when you graduate. Contact a counselor and plan a cool summer of hot classes today. Summer session classes begin June 7th. Achieve more, earn more. Shasta College. www.shastacollege.edu. Enroll today at Shasta College.
Meet Stella the Seahorse and her companions in Washed Ashore, Art to Save the Sea, now on display at Turtle Bay Exploration Park. Delightful and shocking, this indoor-outdoor exhibition highlights the perils of plastic pollution. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We say hello and thank you to all our listeners on our affiliate KGFW, 1340 AM, 96.1 FM in Kearney, Nebraska. Thank you for listening to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined by Dr. Dan Copeland, Chairman of the Education Department at Hillsdale College and also Professor of Education. Dr. Copeland, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Scott.
We talked today about Aesop's Fables. And right away we should do this because we just did this off the air.
Sure.
Aesop? Aesop. Is there correct pronunciation?
Well, you know what? There probably is, but we should probably get someone in here from the classics department to be able to tell us. But I think it's that tomato, tomato.
We'll go Aesop in the course of this interview.
Sounds good.
You can find out more about Aesop's Fables as part of the classic children's literature course available at online.hillsdale.edu, and we'll talk about it here today. So, who was Aesop, and where did he get these stories?
Yeah, it's a great question. So here's what I tell my students typically is anytime you talk about Aesop, you have to use the opening, you know, prepositional phrase, according to legend, because we don't really know anything specific about him. We're pretty confident he actually did exist. I mean, Herodotus, Aristotle, Plato, Plutarch, they all refer to him in their writing. But what we know specific about him and what we know to be true, again, much of it is just legend. The idea of what we know about is probably he was born a slave somewhere around, you know, modern day Turkey. And actually, according to legend, I'll stop saying this, but he was a deformed, you know, physically in some way, but also he did not have the ability to speak, or when he spoke, he had real trouble, and that somehow, you know, he was given, you know, the gift of speech, but also the gift and the ability to be able to speak eloquently and to speak well. And actually he made quite a career of himself and actually worked for, you know, for nobles and kings, being able, you know, to speak on their behalf. So the question usually comes up of, well, how many of these stories that we have, these hundreds and hundreds of stories that we call Aesop's fables, are actually, can we attribute to Aesop himself? And we have no idea. We do know that many of the stories that we now associate with Aesop probably were not created by him. They were collected by others, maybe even around, you know, the first century AD or something like that. But kind of like how when we call an American dictionary a Webster's, you know, a dictionary, Aesop's fables is kind of a genre in terms of fables and in terms of storytelling. Whether they actually came from him or not, we just don't know.
This is a collection of short stories, fables, each with a lesson, hopefully, if you read it the right way. What are some of the best-known stories that people would know from fables?
Yeah, so it's amazing. His stories are so well known; they've kind of worked their way into almost, you know, all stories and in storybooks. But you know, it's things like the tortoise and the hare, you know, the lion and the mouse, or the fox and the cheese, the town mouse, and you know, the city mouse. All of those stories are just kind of part of who we are now, and it's amazing how many kind of sayings that we you know, talk about. For example, I was listening to the radio just last week, and someone talked about belling the cat, and that's one of the stories of Aesop's fables. So we get a lot from Aesop.
You mentioned all the names of those stories, and they're all animal-based, right? What's the point, or what's the benefit of using animals to sort of discuss these political, you know, lowercase p, or social concepts?
Yeah, so it's interesting because G.K. Chesterton said, you know, the best fables have animals in them, you know, and you could kind of take that conversely, that, you know, the worst fables have people in them. and I believe there are two reasons why animals feature quite prominently in the majority of these fables. You know, number one is we can draw on the features of the animals themselves without a lot of, you know, kind of a backstory. So remember, a lot of these fables are very, very short. You know, if you have a collection of these, typically the majority of them are going to be about a paragraph or two long. And so you've got to accomplish a lot in that short amount of time. So if you can say the lion, you know, or the fox or the peacock, well, automatically you attribute certain features of those animals to those characters. So you know that a lion is going to be large and strong and courageous, and a fox is going to be sly, and you're going to have to watch out for him because he's going to twist things. And a peacock, of course, is going to be proud. So you can accomplish a lot just by identifying, you know, the lion, and we know that. Another reason, I think, is that the reason for, you know, the fable is as I was once told, where a joke has a punchline, a fable has a moral. So it has a specific moral that it, it's trying to teach. And typically that moral is going to be targeting a particular vice. Not all of human behavior, but one particular thing about humanity. And so by using animals, the storyteller can draw again on what we know about that animal, but we can pinpoint a particular vice very, very quickly. Human beings are very complex. As we know, all the people who we know were not just one particular feature. And so anytime we bring a human being into the story, things get complex.
Dr. Dan Copeland with us talking about Aesop's fables. Each one of these fables has a moral, a lesson. Are there certain themes or major lessons that sort of weave their way through multiple works?
Yeah, so again, according to legend, the idea was, you know, that Aesop would travel around, you know, to these different, you know, locations, and he would identify a particular vice, and he would pull out a particular story that would address a particular, you know, kind of vice. And so what's really interesting is if you read across all of other fables, there are these particular fables that seem to contradict each other. So you might have a particular fable that says, you know, be kind. But then you read a story like the ant and the grasshopper, for example. And in the original story, when the grasshopper, who has wasted his time, you know, playing his musical instrument while all the ants work, when he arrives at the door in midwinter when he's cold and has no food, in the original story, the ants turn him away, right? And they say, you know, you were dancing in summer, you know, keep on dancing, kind of a thing. Well, you know, that's not teaching kindness, mm-hmm. right? What it is teaching, though, is that, you know, there's a reason why we work, and being thrifty and working hard and providing for ourselves. So to your question, yes, there is an overarching ethic here in terms of it's not going to be teaching, you know, a dishonesty, and it's not going to be teaching, you know, people to cultivate particular kinds of vices. It is about, you know, cultivating the virtues of honesty, of prudence, of wisdom, of justice, and all of that. But you need to do that in collection, because the particular story is actually addressing one particular thing.
Final question. Would maybe it makes no difference at all. Would you say to read Aesop's Fables in a linear fashion or more like a reference book?
Yeah, so, well, the great thing about it is you can read it to almost anyone because they're so short. You know, if you start a book like Treasure Island or, you know, The Secret Garden or something like that, it's a longer book, and it's going to take a lot more time. You're rewarded for that investment because you really immerse yourself in the world. But the one great thing about Aesop's Fables is, you know, my kids would ask me, you know, for a story before, you know, they went to bed. And I realized we didn't have a, you know, time to read a chapter, you know, in The Wind in the Willows, but we did have time enough to read one of Aesop's Fables. And so just read a little bit every day, or read one every day, you know, just kind of make it part of your routine. And I think that's the best way to encounter those stories.
Dr. Dan Copeland, Chairman of the Education Department and Professor of Education at Hillsdale College. More on Aesop's Fables and a great bunch of children's literature works in the Classic Children's Literature course, the online course at online.hillsdale.edu. Dr. Copeland, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Yeah, thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Will Morrissey, who joined us talking about his essay at Real Clear Public Affairs, Civic and Moral Virtues, The American Way. Ken Starr discussing his brand new book, Religious Liberty in Crisis. And Dan Copeland took us through Aesop's Fables. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews on the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. The assistant producer of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Nate Esbenshade. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is a second-generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Reading area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423. Advanced Automotive.
The world is full of obvious things which nobody by any chance ever observes. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Before we get started on today's episode, we want your questions. Every December, we talk about specific questions that we receive from you so we can answer them and make sure that we're addressing your specific needs. So if you have a question, contact us, let us know what it is, so we can answer it for you.
There are a couple ways to do that. You can either find us on Facebook, send us a message that way, or of course, the email address at the end of this episode is a great way to contact not only your questions, but episode ideas and commentary about how fantastic my voice is.
So let's get into today's episode. What's the topic?
We are talking about using your senses, not just what I see or what I hear, but what I'm tasting, what I'm smelling. This is a common bit of advice you hear from third grade teachers. Make sure you include all five senses in the scene.
The reason why senses are so important is that it immerses the reader into the moment with something that they can connect with that otherwise they wouldn't understand. While most of your readers may not know what, say, a homeless person who lives on the streets most of the time and never gets a shower smells like, you do know what a boy's gym locker room smells like after a day of football practice. These are small little details that you can connect the dots to give them an idea of the senses of what they're seeing, hearing, tasting, because readers want to be in the moment. They want to be in the world, and the senses is how you do that.
Not necessarily strictly smells, although that is a great one to give an idea of environment, but if your character can taste the rain in the air before the storm, that's something your readers can relate to.
So we mentioned earlier the five senses. We're aware that that's probably what you've been taught. That's what we were taught. That's what we were familiar with. But there are so many more senses than just five.
In this particular case, we're talking about ways that we interact with the world, ways that the world gives our brains information. Not necessarily seeing dead people like the sixth sense or an emotional IQ, these other things that are part of the human experience, but literally how you get information from the world.
Physical interactions. The most common that you're going to be using in a book is vision, what they're seeing.
And this tends to be the default for a lot of storytellers because a lot of storytellers also watch TV, also go to the movie theaters. You see and you hear a lot of things in cinema, and therefore when you're seeing the story play out in your head, it's sight and sound based often.
So that's the second sense, is the hearing. Your third is smell. This can be so important. Because people remember smells really well. There are actually studies linking smell with memory. So if you can introduce them to a smell that they are familiar with, you are connecting them with a story on a new level.
Smell is closely intertwined with taste. They're right next to each other on the face, yes, but a lot of the words you're going to use are very similar. That saltiness, that nuttiness. Talk about tea tasting or wine tasting. They will say a perfuminess to the flavor, the bouquet of the wine.
Speaking as someone who has a lot of allergies that affect my sinuses, your smell affects your taste. If I can't smell anything, I really can't taste much. It has to be a very strong flavor for me to taste it.
This particular list has 9 different kinds. We got that list from talkingmatters.com. And what we in kindergarten learned as touch is not only texture, something is soft or silky, but also temperature, something is hot or cold, but also pain.
Which also goes with hot and cold because a lot of pain is associated either with hot or with cold.
Those are all kind of in the touch category, but I wanted to make sure we talked about each of these separately because there are different ways for your...
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.